We're doing a story tonight on the family, Jeff Charlotte's new book. It's fascinating. It's easy to read. It lays out both the history of the organization and also the sort of philosophical slash theological understanding behind the family, the secret fundamentalism at the heart of American power. But that's not just the whole story, actually. It's not just American power, it's international power. We'll talk more about that, too. Some of the other countries whose leaders are members of the family. And just how much power does this organization have? We'll put on our list of subjects to get back to coming up this hour, past evidence of when the family has flexed its muscle, what it's been able to do just because it decided to do it. Regardless of whether it was in the best interest of the United States or anybody's interest other than their own, what have they been able to do? Or is this just an organization with a lot of dreams, but not any real way of achieving them? We'll also get back to where we left off at the top of the hour. They're talking about the members of the C Street Group, kind of a who's who of senators and congressmen. A couple Democrats, mostly Republican, who are dedicated to the family. So dedicated are they that when asked about their below market value housing that they're given, they said, well, it's a secret. I can't tell you. It's a secret in a democracy from elected people. We'll get back to this. Just what is it? What does it mean to be part of the new chosen? And how is one chosen? How is one determined to be one who receives this special revelation of God? Next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. Let's go back real quickly to something which we just touched on toward the end of last hour. There are a couple of different places that the family maintains. We're talking with Jeff Charlotte, the author of The Family. And this, the C Street House is just one of them. Mention some of the other places that they also own.
Well, there's a nearly $7 million mansion in Arlington called the Cedars. It's at the end of a cul-de-sac. Arlington, Virginia is a neighborhood for those not familiar with that area. It's very close to the Pentagon, close to the CIA, and a lot of career folks live there. This is actually registered as a safe house with the CIA. It's a beautiful white-pillared mansion overlooking the Potomac. They've carved a waterfall into the front lawn. They actually built up, they drew up blueprints for an underground bunker, which they never ended up building. But it gives you a sense of their view of the world. It was going to be a chapel, but unlike most chapels, it was going to be circular with concentric rings of access to power. And in the middle of it was going to be the leader of the group, Doug Coase, real cult of personality. Around that, there's a number of houses that serve it. There's a house called Potomac Point for young women who serve the Cedars. Women are not expected to have any kind of leadership roles. They're expected to be submissive. About 20 properties in the neighborhood, including one called Ivanwald, which is a house for young men who were being groomed for leadership. And I spent about a month, a little less than a month, living there. There's another set of houses like that in Annapolis. And then when you start going overseas, you start seeing properties that have been given to them by the leaders of foreign governments. So one of their real early successes was with the late Ethiopian dictator Haile Selassie, who deeded them a fabulous property right near his palace in downtown Addis Ababa in Ethiopia. But I mean, that's just one example. It's really very international group, and has always seen their mandate as not just covering up affairs for their members like Senator Henson and so on, but really seeking a certain kind of power internationally.
Right. And I'll get back to the Senator Henson story and how that cover up and how this relates to the family. But I had to make a note. So there's like a list somewhere of registered safe houses with the CIA, and how safe can those houses be?
No, you know, the interesting thing about the safe house, first of all, they're not terribly safe. A safe house is not as sort of skull and bones as it sounds. A safe house, a CIA safe house or a government safe house simply means a place to which a member of the government can retreat if something was to go wrong in Washington, if they had to, for instance, evacuate the city or something like that. And the way I found this out, actually, and this was sort of a fascinating sort of side excursion. So there's about these 20 houses in this neighborhood. Well, it turns out the family, among other things, are very bad neighbors, and they offended all the women of this neighborhood. And these women banded together and started investigating. And they were some women who knew how to investigate. One is a professor of investigative journalism at George Washington. Another was a retired anthropologist. Another is a very high-up Pentagon official herself. She was the one who managed to get a hold of the blueprints for the bunker. The investigative, the professor of investigative journalism was the one who was able to discover that this had been listed as a safe house. Now, you don't want to make too much of that. What's more significant is the fact that this is the $7 million mansion, paid for with donations given to them by the CEOs of leading defense companies and oil companies, and they're using it. They're using it to conduct private meetings with foreign leaders, which is illegal, technically, but more importantly, to sort of indoctrinate their members, who I think a lot of them really join with the best of intentions. A lot of politicians get involved because this sounds like a good thing, but they get indoctrinated in this idea, this very cultish kind of Gnostic approach to religion, which says that there are secret teachings, and the secret teachings are not about any of the wonderful things of Christianity, like love or mercy or justice or forgiveness. It's about power and who God wants to have it and who God doesn't want to have it.
Okay. Always good. Love how you're presenting this material. It's just this interesting in the book, too, for people who want to pick up a copy. You can link up to it through coasttocoastam.com. But Jeff Charlotte, that also sounds kind of Masonic. That idea of the secret rings of power, you know, the knowing ones, working one's way up to the top of the power pyramid. I mean, that's all very much a Masonic model, too.
It is, except, you know, the difference is, I mean, I don't know a whole lot about the Masons. I think that, as far as I can tell, it seems to be a pretty innocuous, you know, club of guys who like to get together and so on, and have, you know, these sort of fun and games. The family is something quite different because they begin from the very beginning as a political organization. Their first meeting takes place in Seattle, Washington, in 1935, and it's a political meeting. The founder gathers 19 wealthy businessmen, and they sit around, and they wait for God to give them a message, and God does. He gives to a young lawyer named Arthur Langley, stands up and says, "I've been selected by God to be the next mayor of Seattle and then the governor of Washington." The 19 businessmen pledge to put their money behind him, a guy named Arthur Langley. This did indeed happen. And this guy, this is not a conservative liberal issue, because both the Republican Party, which he ended up capturing the nomination for, but both the Republicans and the Democrats denounced him for secrecy and fascism. One of his he campaigned with an organization called the New Order of Cincinnatus, and these guys, they really liked the brown shirts. They wore white shirts and green hats, and they did. At one point, they were doing Seacale salutes. Sort of a funny document I found in their archives is when they decided not to do Seacale salutes because they decided that was too fascist, as opposed to just fascist enough.
Yeah, it was just, as he walked past for them to go, "Zeke, Heil," that was just a little over the line.
That was a little over the line. So, I mean, this group, you know, this isn't the Freemasons, because this group begins with this idea of power, but also because they have such a disturbing idea of what it means to be chosen. We were talking about that before the break, and if I could give you one example, which I think is very telling. David Coe, he is the longtime leader of the group, sometimes referred to his first brother, is a man named Doug Coe. He's in his early 80s. His son, one of his sons, David Coe, sort of heir apparent to the group. David Coe has been in the news, actually, as a spiritual advisor to Senator John Ensign. Let me give you an example of the kind of spiritual advice he gives. When I was living with the group, David Coe came around. He wanted to talk to us about the King David story. That's also been in the news. Remember, Mark Sanford of South Carolina said he wasn't going to resign because he's like King David. So we know modesty is not a virtue for these guys. And here's what they mean by King David. It's a core teaching of the family. He says, why do we, speaking to a group of men, says, why do we respect King David? And one guy says, because, you know, he had a great heart for God. And David Koh says, no, that's not it. Another guy says, because he was a very good man. He tried to be a good man. David Koh says, no, that's not it. He says King David's a terrible man. He says, King David, and we remember our Bible, seduces Bathsheba and then arranges to have her husband killed. Now, he's, of course, ignoring the rest of the story in which King David learns, you know, what he's done and so on. He's only interested in that part. And he says, and yet God still likes this guy. So that's what it means to be chosen. He says, let me give you a contemporary example. He turns to one of the young men. He says, suppose I hear you raped three little girls. What would I think of you? And this guy, who is, you know, a human being, says, you'd think I was awful. You'd think I was a monster. And David Koh says, no, I wouldn't, because you're chosen. That's what it means to be chosen. Now, it's important to make the distinction. They're not telling you to go rape three little girls. They're not telling you to do these horrible things. But if you do, it doesn't matter. You're still chosen for power. And when you take that overseas and the kind of killers that they've aligned themselves with, Papa Doc Duvalier, Zahardo, these men who killed so many of their own people, you start to see what they mean when they say the rules don't apply to our members.
Yeah, this idea about the new chosen, how is one chosen to be chosen? Or how does one prove oneself as having already been chosen yet unrevealed yet to the group as already chosen? How does that work?
Well, there's no application. You can't say, hey, you know, I think I'm chosen. Could you set me up with a seat in Congress? Doug Koh, the leader of the group, says we work with power where we can, build new power where we can't. That's historically been their role. They are interested in strongmen. So what they look around is they look around the world, and if you're already in power, well, that's a pretty good sign that you're chosen. If you're already wealthy, that's an even better sign that you're chosen, because one of the things that they believe in is they sometimes call it biblical capitalism. I think some of my conservative friends over at the Cato Institute say call it crony capitalism, which, you know, the rich help each other. They believe that God has chosen who he wants to be rich and who he wants to be poor, and that we should just accept that. If things aren't going well for you financially, that's what God wants to have for you. And he does, however, want these very few rich men to be very, very rich and to decide things for the rest of us. So they say, look, God has already revealed to us. Now, this is, by the way, Christian listeners out there recognize this is heresy. This is not.
Well, it isn't. I mean, that's kind of the prosperity gospel Calvinism that's been going around for a long time. Calvin believed in that belief. John Calvin did that somehow what your status was reflected of your specialness.
It's true enough, but this is dumb. This is really dumbed down Calvinism.
Okay,
and it goes beyond that, because of course being chosen is all about power. It's not about Calvin. You know. Calvin was a Christian. You did have to be, you know, you did have to believe in Christianity. Some of the men that they consider chosen, one of the stories I tell in the book is that of this dictator I mentioned, Siad Barre, the former dictator of Somalia. And this may seem far away and esoteric to us, but think about how in the news we've been hearing about piracy in Somalia. Think about how we hear that Somalia is now a haven for Al-Qaeda, and we want to ask ourselves, how did it get to be like this? What happened to this country that it got so demolished? Well, we go back into the family's archives, and we discovered that in the early 80s, they decided that the dictator of Somalia, Siad Barre, was chosen for Africa by God. Now, this is an odd choice. Siad Barre was not a Christian by a long shot. He described himself as a Quranic Marxist. He hung pictures all throughout the country of himself, Muhammad, and Marx. But one thing that he had in common with them was a real just sort of admiration for brute strength. They started sending Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa, a defense contractor named Bill Brehm, over to pray with him. Barre was a terribly cynical man. He said, I will pray to Jesus. In return, I want something from you. He says, I want my defense budget doubled. He says, I want meetings with the White House for my officials. And I want a no-holds-barred, or I want the United States to look the other way while I crack down on some rebels. Well, Doug Koh, the leader of the group, he arranged this. One thing he did is he arranged in 1983, and this is documented, for Somalia's Minister of Defense to meet with the then chairman of the Joint Chiefs of the Staff. This is the kind of access they had, a guy named General John J. Vesey. Somalia's defense budget was nearly doubled, and Barre used it to wage one of the most violent, horrific, a war of biblical proportion on his own people, from which it has never recovered. The only moment of unity this country has had is when they all rose up and chased this murderous lunatic out, and the family helped him find refuge in Kenya, and they never said that he was anything but chosen for God, because they look at that and they say, well, that must be what God wants for Somalia. Not any God that I think most of us can recognize.
Fascinating. And so I think I would like accept this idea of chosen if there were some sort of divine initiation. You know, if they had to like pull a sword out of a stone or something that proved that there is something going on. But really comes right down to it is, you were invited to go to Ivanwald, which was one of their, if you will, what kind of like their, what, their double A farm team kind of house?
I was a minor league player.
To look for future prospects. If you were invited, well, first of all, did the person who invite you is, after you, now that you've written this expose on the family, are they sitting around going, stupid, stupid, stupid? Like, how do we let him in? And if you were invited in, then how hard would it be to end up in the group of the chosen?
Well,
you could have, right? If you played your cards right, you could have been chosen.
I didn't play my cards. I was sort of a set of circumstances.
I'm not saying
stupid, because I'm still a member. I'm chosen for life whether I want to or not, and they're very clear about this. I'm still a brother.
Wait. You're still a member of the family?
As far as they're concerned, I'm a brother. I'm a bad brother. And they told me this. You know, when I wrote about this for a magazine called Harper's Magazine, and they said, you got everything right. The only rule you broke was you weren't supposed to tell anyone. And they've emphasized this again and again. That's why Senator Sam Brownback gave me access, is he thought I was going to come back to the organization. I tell a story later in the book. I'm sitting around one day. I get this call from this man named Greg Gunum. He's an executive with an international sort of oil company called Pride Former. He was calling from Angola in Africa. He said he just wanted to tell me he liked my writing. I don't get calls like that every day.
Right.
And someone calling from Angola, oil executive, saying, hey, buddy, just like your writing. As we sat and talked for a while, it turns out that Greg had been very involved with the group, and that what he was really doing was telling me, you know what, I should come back. I should come back to the fold. This could be very, very good for my career if I came back to the fold. They could help me. So from their perspective, I was involved. Now, you know, the way I got in, I tell this story in the beginning of the book. An old friend of mine, her brother, had left his career, left his relationship to go move to Arlington to be Arlington, Virginia, to be a part of this. And this family, conservative Christians, they weren't going to be offended by that. That was no problem for them. But this didn't seem right, and they were worried that he had joined a cult. Because I write a lot about religion, they asked if I could meet with him, I did. And he said for me to understand what he was involved in, I really had to see it myself. And so I went and I lived with him. That's the only way you get in, is by invitation. There were some reasons. Ivanwald, the house I lived in, was mostly sort of young men in 20s, a couple in their early 30s, from affluent families. With that kind of support, they liked me partly because I was a writer. They saw I was an influencer, they thought that I would be a good person to have. And so that's how I became a member and remain a member. The rule I'm breaking, though, is in sharing the secrets with the world.
Nobody talks about Fight Club. So we'll come back to the story of the family then, and we left a couple of threads that we need to tie together before we get to your calls coming up at the top of the hour. And I want to talk about some of the things that they've looked the other way on. Jeff Charlotte has mentioned a few of them already internationally. What about domestically? What about the courts? Who do they have in our judicial system that are members of the family? And then let's go back to, we kind of teased it and then we didn't really talk more about it, about covering up crimes when they know they've been committed, or if not crimes and infidelities, and how far out of the way the family will go for you to make sure that you stay in power. Because after all, that's the most important thing to the family. Next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. The story of the family. It's the secretive, attempting to be invisible power structure that exists in Washington within the halls, particularly of the U.S. Senate, calling probably as many as a quarter, maybe as many as a third of U.S. senators either a member of the family or friendly to the family's desires, to the goals that they have. We're talking about a power that is Christocentric, but not in the way in which we might think about what traditional religious fundamentalism, even in this country, is hoping for. It's a group that contains a lot of promise for what it is that they want to do, but how much have they actually achieved? That's one of the questions that's still hanging out here this hour. We'll get back to it next with Jeff Charlotte. What have they been able to do, both in this country and abroad, just because they decided as a family to do it? Next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. Whatever we don't get to, I hope you will address it coming up next hour when we get to some calls on Coast to Coast AM. Jeff Charlotte, the author of The Family, hot new book. How well is this book selling exactly? Do you know?
It's number 4 on the New York Times bestseller list and been there for around the beginning of July. You know, the thing is, this book came out in hardcover last year and it got some good media. NBC News did a segment on it. We had videotape of the leader, Doug Coe, talking about modeling his idea of the fellowship into which he brings politicians. He said, you know, a great model is that of Hitler, Himmler, and Goebbels. So we thought we had a real bombshell, and we thought the press would follow up on it, and they just didn't do anything. This year, I think these scandals at the C Street House,
right,
where these three politicians have been involved in sex scandals covering it up, has gotten people's attention, and so we've gotten a lot more media and doing a lot of stuff. So now it's selling like hotcakes, and my publisher can't print it fast enough, which is good, because I think here's a group that of very powerful men who sign off on a distortion of religion that is opposed to democracy. They're explicitly opposed to democracy, and I think it's something we need to know about.
Explicitly opposed to the democracy that they are supposedly serving. I mean, there's something really disturbing, very cynical about that.
It's a betrayal of trust. I mean, it's the same betrayal of trust, you know, when Governor Sanford abandons his post. But, you know, you asked in the last segment, you know, let's look at things that they've actually done. And I think that that would, you know, maybe best illustrate it.
But what have they been able to do? What, if they decide, let's do X, have they been able to do that?
Yeah, they really have. Why don't I give some domestic examples and some foreign affairs examples, and that's really where they see their strengths. They began with the idea that they were going to break the power of labor unions. And, of course, labor unions have had corruption in the past, but that's not what their concern was. Their concern was they think any attempt by working people to improve their situation is actually an affront to God. So they had members like Henry Ford and these guys and said, yeah, accept your place. So they threw their lobbying muscle into legislation in the late 1947s that rolled back the rights of ordinary working people to get together and advocate for themselves, and they consider that one of their first big victories. They then began moving overseas, and I think one of the ugliest relationships they forged in 1959, they sent two senators, Senator Frank Carlson and Senator Homer Capehart, and a delegation of American businessmen to interview the dictator of Haiti, a man named Papadoc Duvalier, and conclude whether he was worthy of U.S. support. These are two very powerful senators. They were able to swing that if they thought that he was. They concluded that Papadoc was a man of God, as they put it, and went back and organized the United States to start supporting him. The United States poured money into this regime. This guy was as far from a man of God as can be imagined, starting with the fact that he believed he was God, very literally. He thought he was God, and he ruled through, I mean, this stuff sounds like Dan Brown stuff, but it's history, sadly. He ruled through a vicious militia called the Tonton Macoutes, who were a voodoo army. He believed in voodoo. That was his thing, and just terrorized the people of Haiti. We now know, you know, the United States now considers this guy a complete disaster. No one thinks that was a good idea. They started pursuing that further. There's a dictator in Indonesia, Suharto. The CIA called the coup by which he came to power. The U.S. government said this is one of the worst mass killings in the 20th century. Killed up to, we're not sure how many exactly, up to 1.2 million of its own fellow citizens. The family called that a spiritual revolution, and they began sending over congressmen to meet with him. They even hosted him. And they brought him into the U.S. Senate and arranged meetings for him with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And they lobbied very hard for money to go to him. And that's what they do. They act like a lobby. They don't register as a lobby, but they act like a lobby. Domestically, I mean, the list goes on, right, these foreign dictators. But domestically, you look at what they do. And you see, one thing that I think is sort of disturbing is a story I tell in the end of the book. We all know about faith-based initiatives in government,
sure,
and that sounds, you know, that sounds fine enough. You might have, you know, one view or the other on these initiatives. We look in the family's archives, and we see that what they really wanted to do, they began talking about this in the early 1980s and thinking about how this could be done. And what they wanted to do was they wanted to take money, taxpayer money, and put it into the hands of their members, who they felt would best know how to use it. And, I mean, you don't have to take my word on this. There's a man named David Kuo, not to be confused with Coe. He was, as a young congressional aide, he wrote the legislation that allowed faith-based initiatives. His career came through the family. He then went on to serve high in the Bush White House. And he then came to renounce what he had done. He said, this is, we use this for transparent political gain. This was it was a crass power grab. This is not some liberal saying. This is a conservative saying this. He calls the family the most powerful group in Washington that nobody knows. He says their reach into governments around the world is impossible to overstate or even grasp. And there's a conservative sociologist. Again, I make these points because I don't want anyone to think that this is some kind of partisan thing. This is not a left-right issue. This is a secret group issue. Conservative sociologist did a survey of 360 evangelical politicians. Said, what's the most influential religious group in Washington? And the family came out on top, which is something for an organization that says it doesn't exist.
Right, it's such a low profile that it's so well known by a certain group of people. So what are some of the things that have been done either by members of the family or done kind of in concert with the goals of the family, which many of us might consider to be crimes, which they look the other way on? Or better, they hear it and they go, yeah, well, good. Great. Good job.
They don't look the other way. With these guys like Suharto and so on, they think it's terrific. And an example I tell in the book, there's a contemporary dictator named Museveni in Uganda. They consider him now God's new chosen man for Africa. In 1997, an associate of the family named Dennis Bakke met Museveni through the family. Museveni then gave him, Bakke was the CEO of a giant corporation called AES. Museveni gave him a no-bid contract for a $500 million, that's $500 million hydroelectric dam that was a complete boondoggle, a complete disaster for the country. They consider that a sign of God's work. Senator Brownback explained to me how this could work. He said, it was a piece of legislation that he's been working on called the Silk Road Act. And a lot of the legislation they work on is stuff that nobody pays attention to. They're talking about the Central Asian Republics, countries a lot of Americans aren't familiar with, but they have a lot of oil, they have a lot of natural gas, they're very important strategically. He said, what I want to do is I want to funnel U.S. aid to these dictators who run this country. And he's going to work with his brother in the family, a guy named Joe Pitts from Pennsylvania. He says it's going to have three advantages. He says, one, it's going to help these dictators fight Islamic radicalism, and that's just the opposite of what happens there, so that's not very effective. He says, two, it's going to open these countries up to American investment. Well, that's fine. Let's take a closer look at that. The company with the biggest interest in that is called Koch Industries, which also happens to be Sam Brownback's biggest financial backer. What's good for them is good for him. He says, three, where American money follows, the gospel follows. Or where American money goes, the gospel follows. And got to remember, when he's talking about the gospel, he's not talking about what you hear on Sundays in church. He's talking about this religion of power. And that's the way that they're pursuing this legislation that expands their influence around the world and, frankly, contradicts American interests. This is not good for the United States to have these senators playing, you know, rogue maverick policies, promoting this kind of very brutal sort of cult of personality that's endangering the United States. And I think that's a core issue.
Sure. And it's not just senators, too. We should point out there's been quite a few judges that have been associated with the family. So even if something did get to a court somewhere, just like in the old days, perhaps, when somebody flashed a Masonic symbol to a judge, there might be some friendly sort of behind-the-scenes arrangements for family members.
Well, sure. The most famous of them is William Rehnquist, who recently died. Remember the Supreme Court, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, who was very powerful for many years. In the archives, we see that he began studying the Bible according to the family, with the family, under their guidance, as early as 1974. Of course, after he died, we learned that he had been addicted to drugs for many years. We got to question this guy's judgment. Another interesting judicial story I found in the archives is the Watergate felon Chuck Colson. Some
yeah.
people may remember him,
sure.
Chuck Colson. Not a religious man, but converted to religion of some sort through the family. Doug Coe, the leader of the group, came and sat down with him and converted him, did go to prison, committed a felony, was released to the family. And I have the letters from the parole board. They wrote to the parole board saying, release him. We're going to use him to pursue our ends. Now, some people have a lot of respect for Chuck Colson. They say, well, Chuck
yeah.
Colson was reformed. And,
right.
And
prison evangelist.
Yeah, he's done some good things, but there's a cynicism there. I have a letter in which he says, I discovered that which I could not achieve politically, I could achieve the exact same ends if I called it religion, if I used religion. And you want to say, boy, Chuck, I don't know if you learned your lesson. The idea was not to pursue those exact same ends that got you thrown in prison for
right.
abusing power. The
right.
goal was to learn that there's a different message here. So again and again, they're able to sort of run interference for the members. A congressman named Kurt Weldon from Pennsylvania used an event that they host every year called the National Prayer Breakfast. That sounds innocuous enough. The president always comes and speaks. Most of Congress goes, foreign heads of state. It's in the Washington Hilton. It's a pretty dull affair. What people don't pay attention to is the week-long lobbying fest that goes on around it. Congressman Kurt Weldon certainly did. He used it as an opportunity to bring in two Serbian war criminals with interest to Russian oil, represented by his children, who were lobbyists. And you see this again and again and again, this kind of crass cynicism.
Right.
And I once asked, because I spent a lot of time with him, I asked them, I said, you know, aren't you worried that these guys, let's give you the benefit of the doubt, you have the best of intentions, aren't you worried that someone's going to use this? And they said, well, I'd rather let in a wolf than keep out a lamb. And you look at their history, and they've got a whole pack of wolves in there.
Right.
And they don't have any. The wolves ate the lambs.
Yeah.
It does become this kind of power call. And on the one hand, you want to say, well, it's just like these guys getting rich. But the frightening thing is that the men and at the heart of the group, they really believe this. They really believe in this strange theology of creating a 1,000-year rule of working through strong men and killers. And they say that God has chosen them for this special mission. That's the story I'm trying to tell in the family, not just, you know, political intrigue.
It's the new chosen. That's the way they look at themselves in the family. Jeff Charlotte's the author. So, circling back to where we were about this time last hour, we started talking about how they helped to cover up some of these infidelities and, in some cases, what might even be a misappropriation of funds by elected officials when it comes to girlfriends, hookers, that sort of thing. What do you know for sure about what the family has done to try to rehabilitate the chosen members that had chosen badly?
It's an interesting process. You look at they originally called this this soul surgery, and the house on C Street. They speak of having soul surgery, and that comes from a place in American history, a guy named Frank Buckman. And this group called Moral Rearmament, Buckman had this idea that he could bring wealthy people together, and they'd get into a small group, and they would begin with a series a round of sexual confession. You would talk about your sexual sins. Of course, what this does is this bonds you to one another. Senator Brownback explained to me this is in fact exactly what they do, and then you might reveal a message one has for the other. Now, I witnessed this on a small scale when I was living with a group. We discussed one man who had been living with them, and just the nightmare scenario. He was engaged. His fiance had been raped and was in another state, and he wanted to get on the next plane, of course, to fly home to see her. And the men who within this group have veto power over his life. That's what you do. You agree to give the men in your group veto power over his life. They said no. They said if she was raped, that's God's way of telling you that you're not supposed to be with her, that he doesn't want her for you, and you have to ask why was she in a place where she got herself raped. They said she was a Jezebel and that he was not to go to her. Now, that guy had the good sense to say, to heck with that, and walked out the door.
Right.
Unfortunately, there's a lot of tales of sort of small-scale broken lives like that of men where the family, and say, trying to help someone deal with this issue. So for Senator Ensign, who is sleeping with his one of his aides, who was the wife of his best friend, the affair began while they were living in his house, because their own house was having some work done. So, you know, his wife and her husband were sound asleep, and they're sneaking off in the corner. He's doing all this while this guy is then going out in the public and proclaiming himself a, you know, good moral man, all this kind of thing. They told him not to do it. They did. We know that they told him not to do it. And they also counseled him to give the mistress money. And his family, a casino fortune in Nevada, gave, we now know, at least $96,000 in small payments so that it wouldn't attract attention to the IRS. In other words, if you're acting legit, if you're trying to be honest and make amends, you don't do things to hide your money.
Right.
Like that.
And it was actually his father and mother who had spontaneously decided to give his mistress money.
Well, spontaneously, the family calls this the man-to-man financial method. They sometimes like to call themselves a Christian mafia, although, as we've discussed, they're not particularly Christian. But they move money around in curious ways. Again, I've been very heartened by the example of the Christian Right magazine, World Magazine, which is a very conservative Christian organization. They looked at the finances of this group, and they said, hey, this is really not appropriate. They're moving money in ways that may, in fact, be illegal and so on. But the one thing that they really like to do is they say, let's move money off the books. So if I want to support you, I'm not even going to do it through a formal organization that's accountable, that, you know, people can say, hey, I want to support that or not. Doug Coe, the leader of the group, says, he says, I loan or give money to hundreds of my friends or have my other friends do this. This is a man who's been flying around the world on private jets for decades that are loaned to him, given to him.
Right.
And that's exactly the kind of money movement that we saw in the Senator Ensign case. So when they defend themselves by saying, hey, this is just a personal group and we tried to help him, they tried to help him cover it up, and, you know, right down to actually helping him write the breakup letter. And then
we'll get back to this coming up. We're missing it on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.